in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Central Illinois Life versus Consolidated Coal. Mr. Montgomery.
Members of this court, my name is Barry Montgomery. I represent Central Illinois Light Company. I wish to make two points with respect to my presentation. With respect to the question of whether or not CILCO ever received a commitment from counsel in this case, I would like to point the court to a letter which is document found in the Appellee's Index at tab C at 257. And this reference...
How are we supposed to look at it? Is it in front of us?
I'm not sure what you have in front of you. It's the attachment to the... I'll read from it. Here's the quotation I would like to make. It references the submissions with respect to what has been designated by counsel as mere negotiations with respect to this contract. Counsel, quote, counsel acknowledges that it proposed and for several months was in the process of negotiating with CILCO a possible contract pursuant to which its Rim Lake mine would be delivered to coal from its Rim Lake mine would be delivered to CILCO's Edwards Station during the year 2001 and 2002. Counsel denies, however, that it ever committed itself to such a contract. I submit that that is a false statement, and it is...
Wait. Now I've lost your thread. Not what you can do with a false statement. The problem I have with your case is that you seem to be saying, maybe I'm misconstruing you, that if there's an exchange of documents in a contract negotiation, then the statute of frauds is inapplicable because there are documents. Isn't that what your position amounts to?
No, I'm not.
There are plenty of documents here, but all they show is that, I think, parties were negotiating, not that they ever arrived at a contract.
The parties were negotiating for a formal written contract, but the negotiations with respect to the issue of quantity was agreed upon. There is a document found in the record, which
they
I can't
have agreed on the quantity, but if they haven't agreed that they have a contract, because there's this testimony by this fellow Bach that CILCO was out looking for presumably cheaper alternatives. So, and there's also evidence that the contract would have had to be approved by higher-ups at Consolidated. So doesn't that suggest that a contract had not yet been made?
A written contract had not yet been made, but you will find that the issue with respect to whether or not it could be approved by upper management does not appear in later drafts.
Whether it appears in earlier or later drafts, I don't know that people have to keep repeating it. CILCO was never informed that the higher-ups had approved the contract. We have no reason to, no evidence it was.
Well, I would like to...
And if CILCO was out looking for other, you know, better offers, cheaper coal, that would suggest it didn't consider itself bound.
That is a statement made by counsel, a self-serving statement.
Well, that's fine, but it is nothing to contradict it.
We can't dispute it,
but there's no contrary evidence. You could have put in a deposition or an affidavit to the effect that NoFoco was not looking for other deals. But I don't think there's anything like that in the record, is there?
We weren't permitted to do anything, any such thing. We wanted to
you
take additional discovery.
You weren't permitted to put affidavits in the record?
Affidavits we could have put in, yes.
Yeah.
But we dispute that issue.
When there's sworn evidence, as in a deposition, introduced on summary judgment, you can't just deny it. You have to have evidence which suggests that it's false. It doesn't have to be a direct, you know, refutation. But what is the evidence to suggest that Silco wasn't looking for a better deal somewhere?
Because there is no evidence that they did.
That's about what Bach said. I mean, Bach...
How does Bach know that?
How does Bach know that?
Bach is from Consul. That's a self-serving statement.
Well, of course it's self-serving, but it is a statement within Bach's ability to make, because, after all, he knows the business, he knows Silco, and if you're, you know, you can know that your contract, that your negotiating partner is looking for a better deal. He tells you, or other people in the industry tell you, if Silco tells you, it's an admission by a party opponent. So I don't think it's inadmissible evidence, certainly not conclusive, but you could easily have put in, because it's your company, you could easily have put in an affidavit which says, no, Silco wasn't looking elsewhere. It considered itself contractually bound.
But, Judge Posner, we're at this point, we're just looking at the statute of frauds. And I believe that there is an indication.
Isn't that the problem? What you seem to be saying is that any activity that is documented in accordance with the statute of frauds is also an enforceable contract. And therefore, if people are negotiating on five terms and they happen to agree on price and contract, bingo, they have a contract, even though they still think they're negotiating. Why would that be true?
We're not stating the negotiations for the fact that the negotiations in and of themselves indicate that there is a contract. We believe that there's evidence in the record that there was a commitment, and I cite the court to the July 20, 2001 letter to Sandra Isbell, notice of force majeure, and here's what counsel says on July 30, 2001.
Is this your appendix?
This is contained in the appellee's appendix.
I think the best documents you would have put in your brief, right? You have this long appendix with a...
I submit, Your Honor, this,
are they their best? Do you have something better?
This is a de novo review, and I submit this was an oversight, and I reviewed this. I saw this document when preparing for this argument. Here's what it says.
And what's the record reference?
The reference is page 312 of the Appellee's Volume 2, Appellee's Index. And it says, in this letter, signed by...
Volume 2, page what?
312. Okay. From Ron LaFlorjack, Executive Vice President of Consul. Here's what it says. As of 8 a.m. today, the long wall is still operational. He cites the force majeure problems, and then here's what he says. As soon as the long wall resumes its expected production level, we will advise you of the total production loss due to the unforeseen circumstances and its effect on your tonnage commitment, that's his word, not mine, for calendar year 2001. The term commitment, according to Webster's Dictionary, means a pledge or promise, obligation. This is written confirmation as of July 30, 2001 of a promise. I just want to point out one other thing with respect to the court below found written corroboration of the oral contract, but it turned on a signature issue. I submit to you that if the court looks at the admissions, these are not oral statements. This is not testimony. These are admissions in which counsel admits that the, and I cite to paragraphs 14, 15, and 16 of defendant's found in the record at D36, defendant's response to plaintiff's allegedly undisputed material facts, where counsel admits that counsel tracks its sales contract on its internal coal sales invoicing system. Counsel also admits that this system is used as a vehicle to generate invoices and serve as an internal accounting tool. Further admits that Consolidation inputs into the CSIS computerized system is prepared by John Bach. I submit to you, when you look at these CSIS system documents, on the issue of signature, where it says right on top, coal sales invoicing system, which is germane only to counsel, that this establishes authentication with respect to the signature requirement. And I submit.
Well, are you arguing now, if we look at A8 in your brief, which says coal sales invoicing system order print?
Yes.
Now, is your view that is an invoice that Silco had to pay?
No, this is the internal document generated within console, admittedly, that tracks what their invoices for coals are about. This is the document relied upon by the court to establish that indeed there was corroboration of the oral agreement. With respect to the liberal construction of the word signature, I submit that the words coal sales invoicing system on each of these pages from the Chicago office fit squarely within the admission that this is a corroboration of a document that is counsel's document and supports the signature requirement of the UCC. I submit in this case what is happening here is counsel is using the statute of frauds as a sword, not as a shield. They're turning it on its head. These documents clearly corroborate the written agreement. And to say that this document, these coal sale agreements, coal sales invoicing system, CSIS documents, which are germane only to counsel, they were produced, they're self-authenticating under Federal Rule of Evidence 902. To say that they don't meet the signature requirement is simply ludicrous. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. Mr. Weiss.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Judge Mim was correct in granting judgment in favor of consolidation in finding the plaintiff did not come forward with any writing that satisfied the statute of frauds, and that writing must state or show on its face that the parties had in fact entered into not any contract, but the contract being sued upon in the case. That contract, Silco alleges, was formed on December 14, 2000, for 900,000 tons of coal for the year 2001 and 600,000 tons of coal for the year 2002, a two-year contract. This case is a classic example of why the statute of frauds exists. As this court has explained, in its earlier case of Consolidation Services, which is cited in our brief, a 1999 Seventh Circuit case, the purpose of the statute of frauds is to provide protection against the risk and cost of being hauled into court and accused of owing money on the basis of an unacknowledged promise. It is designed to protect contractor negotiating parties from the vagaries of the trial process. And a party must prove the making of the alleged contract solely from the documents signed by the party against whom the contract is sought to be enforced. In this case, I think as Judge Posner recognizes, and all of you honors recognize, the documents in this case not only show that there was no contract entered into, but in fact, that there was no contract in fact made. It clearly shows that the parties were negotiating toward a contract, but never concluded one.
Well, is that an issue? Is the only issue for us statute of frauds, or is there an alternative ground for affirmance that there was no contract?
Your Honor, we have the issue, I think, addressed by the court below was on the statute of frauds, and that was the issue before it. We think clearly there was no contract, and that's what the documents show. But that was not the issue addressed by the court below. The issue was that the case should be dismissed because of the statute of frauds and the failure of any right.
Your brief seems to argue both points.
Well, I think, Your Honor,
because you did say, well,
the reason our brief argues both points is if you start out by reading,
I'm not sure it does.
Silco started out by simply making the statement, an oil contract was entered into on December the 14th, 2000, without saying that was disputed, without saying anything about it. And so part of our factual statement was to actually show what happened, to rebut that statement. And as our facts show, Your Honor, if in fact a contract had been entered into, if there was this alleged contract made on December 14th, what possible reason could there have been for Silco to come into court and state that it was undetermined when the contract was entered into? What possible reason could there have been for Silco to have identified eight separate persons who they said
entered into the contract? I thought Silco's position was the contract was made on December 14th, 2000.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's their position.
Correct.
And I'm saying is that was their position. Why did they come into court and say, we don't know, we can't determine when it was entered into initially, in the answer to the interrogatory that we submitted? In their petition, they simply said there was a contract entered into in December, no date, 2000. They didn't attach any writing or refer to any writing in the petition. We then asked them in the first interrogatory we submitted, when was it entered into, who entered into it, and what was its terms? And they came back and said, it's undetermined when it was entered into. And the following people entered into it, and they named eight people. Then they came back after we filed our motion for summary judgment, and when we asked the court to require them to be more specific in their answer, after discovery, they amended their answer to state that the contract was entered into between Sandy Isbell and John Bach on December 14th. Now, that was contrary to the position they took before the lawsuit, when they basically said the contract was evidenced by a confirmatory memorandum dated December 13th sent by Aunt Sandy Isbell, which confirmed a contract that the parties previously had entered into where they agreed upon volume, price, and quantity. That December the 13th letter that she signed simply says, here's what we understand your current counterproposal is, Silco. Let us know whether that's correct. That's what that letter says. It's not a confirmatory writing of any agreement entered into. It's simply trying to confirm her understanding of what the latest counterproposal was. There is no written response to that, either by Silco or Consolidation, or certainly there's nothing that Silco has which says, we accept it. Yes, it's what we understand, and we accept it. There's nothing like that. The UCC, I think, clearly instructs us to provide common sense and use commercial experience in determining these issues. And I submit to the court, if in fact, after negotiating from September into December of 2000, the parties had reached an agreement for a two-year contract for 900,000 tons the first year and 600,000 tons the second year at approximately $34 million value, Sandy Isbell would have made some note, some memorandum, at least to her superiors, if she didn't even send it out to us, that yes, we agreed today on such and such a contract. There is no.
What is Isbell's rank in the company?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I think she is a buyer of coal, but I don't know her specific title or rank.
She's not a vice president or something?
I do not believe so,
says
Your Honor.
She's an adult person of sound mind. Well, that's a start.
Yeah.
Oh, she says I'm a fuel analyst.
I do not think she's an officer, but I don't know that, Your Honor.
Yeah. I mean, she says, I'm the person primarily responsible for negotiating and entering into contracts with coal suppliers. So.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think below, they, SoCo alleged on three sets of documents. Thesis documents, as Mr. Montgomery talked about, emails submitting drafts of contracts, and a one-page list of quantities. And none of those, standing alone, or even if you could read them together, satisfy the statute of frauds. This case is far different from your case, Judge Posner, and Monetti, where you actually had two memorandums setting forth the terms of the agreement. The first one, you found that we're not going to determine whether that satisfies the statute of frauds, but the second one was written by the marketing director, Raymond Davis. And he basically writes a memorandum summarizing a meeting that he attended on May 19th. And he basically says, the parties met on such and such a day and reached the agreement, which is summarized in attachment A here too. That exhibit A sets forth the terms of the agreement, and it's physically attached to his memorandum. If, in fact, after Bach and Isbell supposedly met on December the 14th, Bach went back and wrote a memorandum and said, Sandy Isbell and I met today and we agreed upon the following terms that are set forth in the attached memorandum as Exhibit A. That would be the Monetti case. That is not our case here. It's a far different case. We think Judge Mim was right across the board. None of the documents satisfy the statute of frauds. None of them are signed. You simply can't write the signature requirement out of the statute of fraud. It means something. Somebody has to sign it, as Judge Posner said in Monetti, with the expectation of executing it or adopting it. And there's no such evidence in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Since we're going on that extensive questioning, although your time expired, you may have a minute for rebuttal.
Take the position that you can never have a contract, an oral agreement, because you are negotiating the terms of a written contract. As I view it, logically, that would preclude one from ever. Any time that you have an oral contract that you're going to reduce later to a written contract, the moment you start negotiating the written contract, you have, if you take the argument of counsel, that proves that there was no meeting of the minds with respect to an oral agreement.
No, because you can have, you know, we have this with letters of intent. You can have a contract that's made and binding, even though the parties have left for future negotiation some of the details, which might actually be important details. But I think what's needed is a document that shows, yes, there was a binding commitment. I mean, you did quote that phrase, tonnage commitment. It's unclear whether it means they've agreed on the tonnage or they've agreed on a contract. That's the problem I have. And one of the points Mr. Weiss made in passing, 34, even for these companies, these are large companies, but $34 million is a pretty big contract. So wouldn't you expect there to be really unequivocal evidence that it had been made?
The course of dealing of these parties has been historically that they would enter into an oral agreement. If you will find in the document that the written contract always comes later, after the commencement of the year in which the deliveries of coals are made, they finally get to the written contract. So their course of conduct. You don't find any memorandum in the past with respect to they had a course of conduct, they relied upon each other in good faith. And clearly, these thesis documents, these weren't just pulled out of the air. They indicate, I'm not going to go into all of what they say, but they're corroborated by Mr. Bach himself in terms of the admission of counsel that these are made under his supervision and control. So there is a signature there. The documents indicate who drafted those, and we know from an admission that they're drafted under the supervision and control of Bach. And they lay out exactly the terms with respect to what the oral agreement was about. You asked the question, isn't there another issue here with respect to the oral contract? Not on review in this case, because for purposes of this summary judgment, the only issue was whether or not the statute of frauds was satisfied. Thank you,
Mr. Goodman. Thank you, Mr. Mike. The case is taken under advisement, and the